Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance at the University of Illinois in the College of Business. Once a month, always on a Friday, he's here. We talk a little bit about money management. He begins by making some comments. It could be on some sort of financial planning topic. Sometimes he talks a little bit about the economy and the way things are going. And then after that, we'll take questions. And if you have questions on whatever it is that he's about to discuss, that's fine. Or it can be anything else that has to do with financial planning and money management. I'm sure that he will do his best to help you out. So with that, we say good morning. Welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I have a number of financial matters I'd like to cover this morning. And let's begin with a number of the tax changes effective for 2006. I'm thinking this weekend I'm going to take, well, the grand task of looking at all of those 2005 materials and seeing if I can put them together. But let's talk about some changes for 2006. To begin with, the annual gift exclusion has increased from $11,000 to $12,000. In other words, the first $12,000 of gifts made by a donor to another individual is excluded from income tax and gift tax. The gift could be cash, it could be stocks, perhaps bonds or other personal property. And mom and dad, for example, could give $24,000 jointly to a child entirely free from taxation. Of course, when the child invests the money or anyone else invests the money, and if the money generates interest or dividends or capital gains, then the interest or the dividends, for example, would be subject to tax. There is no limit on the number of annual gifts one could make, so long as the gifts are made to different individuals. So my theory is, I think perhaps maybe Mr. Kezar, a wealthy gentleman like that, should just start gifting perhaps $12,000 to everyone at WILL. That probably would be a big hit. Now, a corollary to this rule involves state-sponsored college education programs. A parent, for example, could gift in 1 year up to $60,000 if the funds are placed in an IRS-approved college savings plan for the benefit of a child. In other words, the parent is essentially using up 5 years of the annual exclusion of $12,000 per year. You can put it all in one particular year, fund a college education savings program, and let that money grow tax-free to be utilized by the child or perhaps another relative in the family. Next, let's talk about Social Security for just a moment. The Social Security maximum wage base has increased from approximately $90,000 to $94,200. What in the world does this mean? Well, it means that an individual who earns $94,200 or more and works for an employer that is part of the Social Security system will pay more than $5,800 in Social Security taxes for the year. And, of course, the employer pays a like amount. The employer matches, if you will, the amount placed by the employee. An individual who is self-employed pays both the employer portion and the employee portion, and therefore could be facing Social Security taxes of approximately $12,000. Just a little bit less, but nevertheless rounding almost $12,000. And in 2005, Social Security paid out, the federal government paid out to the beneficiaries of Social Security more than $500 billion. That's a big number. It's the largest part of our federal budget. Now, many Americans hate the dreaded estate or death tax. In point of fact, in 2005, the estate tax brought into the federal government coffers approximately $25 billion. And while, of course, this is a princely sum, in point of fact, it really represents less than 1.5% of all revenues received from tax sources by the federal government in 2005. But here's the bottom line for 2006. The estate of anyone who dies in 2006 will owe no estate tax so long as the total value of the estate is $2 million or less. And frankly, that covers more than 96% of all Americans. So this death tax, if you will, impacts very, very few people. And for a married couple where one individual dies and leaves everything either outright or in trust to a surviving spouse in excess of $2 million, there also is no tax owing. So those rules are in flux. They're changing, but at least in 2006, very, very few people are going to be faced with the responsibility of estate or death taxes. Now, for those of us working for employers who offer 401k plans or 403b tax-sheltered annuity plans, the level of our employee contributions in 2006 has increased. For example, the maximum employee contribution has increased to $15,000 per year. What a wonderful problem to have if you're in a position and have the cash flow to place $15,000 into your own 401k plan or your own tax-sheltered annuity program sponsored by your employer. And get a load of this, if you're an old person, and the government refers to old people as now over 50, that's an old person, because old people can actually contribute $20,000 per year, or have, in other words, this $5,000 catch-up provision. So I guess, David, you and I have now been relegated not only to eligibility for AARP, but apparently we are now old people under the definitions promulgated by Congress and our federal government. But after all, I guess that is us. Well, let's turn just for a few moments to some macroeconomics. And it seems to be, well, a new era in America. Maybe we should call it the Ben Bernanke era, as he has assumed the chairmanship of the Federal Reserve Board with his debut before Congress really earlier this week. And at least in the short run, the markets liked what he had to say. Even though he said, look, we're forecasting more interest rate increases ahead, at least over the next several months, as I want to make sure that inflation, it's still a major issue, and I want to make certain it doesn't run away, and energy prices remain volatile. I believe that was my understanding of the essential message from Mr. Bernanke. Therefore, it seems to me, look for another Fed funds interest rate bump or increase at the March 28th meeting later this year, and probably a likely further bump in May. In the past, interest rates have been bumped up 0.25% at each of these meetings. So we're probably looking at maybe a prime rate later this year up to 8%. Currently, 30-year mortgages are in the neighborhood of 6.25% fixed. At least that was yesterday's quote from one local mortgage broker. So that could easily move up to 650, 660, perhaps 670. What does that mean for us in terms of investing? Well, CD rates, treasury rates, and national money market rates, at least on the short end of the yield curve, are likely to head higher. So if you exercise patience with your money, higher rates are likely by April 1. Also, it seems to me that it still doesn't make sense to purchase really long-term CDs. So if you're a CD investor and there are some handsome rates available at even our local banks, consider a ladder of CDs or bonds with the longest maturity of perhaps being out there 18 to 24 months. Don't get, well, enamored, let's use that word, with 5 or 10 year certificates of deposit. Don't chase those kinds of yields. You're just not buying enough for the amount of time you're tying up your money. And as I said, look for higher interest rates if you're in the mortgage market. Currently about 6.25, they're clearly going to be moving up if short-term interest rates move up. Typically, when we look at mortgage rates, rates are really tied to the 10-year treasury. The 10-year treasury has been in that 4-6 range, 4-5 range, probably will move just a bit. And unquestionably, if you currently have an adjustable rate mortgage and you're coming up to that period where it has the ability to adjust either up or down, look for a 2% upward adjustment in your ARM. So therefore, think about, again, changing, refinancing, locking in to a fixed rate. Finally, I think it's time once again every month to report on the old notorious couch potato portfolio, which of course consists of 8 different Vanguard Equity Index funds. And as I've mentioned on previous programs, the actual funds and their percentage allocation in the portfolio can be accessed on the WILL website. Well, how's it done this year through yesterday's close? Interestingly enough, sitting on the old couch eating potato chips, our portfolio is up 6.4% for the year through yesterday's close. Obviously, that's a wonderful return. I could almost call it an extraordinary return. No guarantee that it's going to continue. I'm just simply reporting on a portfolio that I utilize myself, for myself, my clients, etc. And at least I guess I'm happy that we're up 6% for the year rather than down 6% for the year. But when we analyze this portfolio, we have to compare it to some type of stock market benchmark. So I generally use the proxy for the U.S. stock market, which is the S&P 500. And the S&P 500, if you're just simply in that this year, you're up 3.5% through yesterday's close. So it's been a good beginning for stock market investors. Again, the couch potato portfolio is an equity portfolio. So remember, it just simply represents one area of your investment pyramid, one area of your investment analysis. So you're going to have some fixed income. You're probably going to have some money markets. Obviously, you need some emergency savings. So this is just one technique for utilizing that portion of your portfolio that you are going to invest in equities. So there you have it, David. I'd be delighted to tackle questions on matters that I've raised or perhaps questions from our WILL audience.
All right. Our guest is David Sinnow. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. He's here once a month on Friday, and we do these programs on money management. So if you have questions, anything he's discussed or anything else that has to do with financial planning, call us. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a caller, and this listener is in Oak Forest. Toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. I just was wondering if we could talk about I-bonds a little bit. They're at 6.7% approximately now, I believe.
Well, are we talking about inflation-indexed treasury bonds?
No.
Or are we talking about the actual I-savings bonds?
The actual I-savings.
Yes, the I-savings bonds have been a great investment for people who are interested in fixed income. Now, the I-savings bond rate is an average rate over a period of time, but it readjusts every 3 months. And basically what has happened is that that rate, because as interest rates have moved up, is now a handsome rate over 6%. And again, the interest is growing tax deferred in that particular investment. So when you cash that bond in, that's when you pay your income tax on the interest. So it's sort of like the old savings bond, if you will. So it's become a very popular investment, and indeed it is certainly outperforming any mutual bond funds. So I'm not a big advocate of mutual bond funds because, again, the advisor in a bond fund is always selling off lower-yielding bonds, buying higher-yielding bonds. And while that sounds like a good idea, the net asset value or the share of the bond fund can actually be reduced. So it's a great investment. It's a good idea. Do you have some of those?
No, but we're going to get some. And the question is seems like local banks don't know a lot about them. Where's a good place to go to purchase them?
Well, in terms of purchasing I-bonds, you can either go through a discount brokerage firm or you can go, I believe, you can go Treasury Direct. I'd have to check on that. Maybe someone who is a purchaser of I-bonds, since I don't purchase them personally, could call in and give us that information.
Okay, thanks very much.
All right, thank you for the call. Let's go on here. The next person in line is in Urbana, and this is line 1. Hello.
Hello. Yes, David, I think your portfolio of 6.4% is remarkable, and I congratulate you for it. You read in the financial press and hear all the time that large cap growth stocks have been undervalued for 5 or 6 years, and that the kind of weighting that your portfolio has, which is towards value and towards smaller and mid-cap, have had a good run. So the question is, would you compensate in any way, or would you make adjustments in any way, or do you believe what all those statements are about large-cap growth funds? That's my question.
It's a great question. It's being talked about all of the time, and what you're really asking me is there some benefit to what we call strategic asset allocation? And that is where we see one particular or two particular asset classes, like the large cap stocks, that many, many people, economists, commentators, analysts, feel are undervalued relative to other asset classes. So very, very large companies or the top tier of the large companies, a lot of folks will argue that those are undervalued relative to the small caps, especially since small caps and small value have had a large run-up, and certainly a larger run-up than certain S&P stocks or even Dow stocks. So the question becomes, in the couch potato portfolio, would it make sense to try to invoke or try to get involved with some type of additional strategic allocation? And the answer for me is no, because this is purely a passive portfolio. I put the percentages on. I look at long-term asset class returns. So I'm not hung up, if you will, on 1, 2, or 3, or even 4-year returns. I'm a legacy investor. I'm a long-term investor. I think like a foundation. So over long, long periods of time, these strategic allocation issues will smooth out. It will smooth out in terms of the return curve. So as a result, I'm not going to try to engage in strategic asset allocation. There's something else that operates here. To do a good job of it, even for me to really, really do a good job of it, I've got to spend a tremendous amount of time understanding each of those asset classes relative to each other in terms of how much they've moved and where the hot markets are going to be. It's not quite market timing. So it's the fancy term strategic allocation. But again, for a legacy foundation-like passive investor, you put the allocation on and then you sit back. So that's what I plan to do. But it's not to say that someone with a lot of investment acumen couldn't engage in some of the strategic allocation, as many money managers do, and outperform the simple couch potato portfolio. I guess only time will tell.
David, may I have one follow-up question?
Sure.
Quickly?
Sure.
Would you adjust this by age of the investor?
No, I would not. And the reason is that, again, this represents only a portion of your portfolio. I'm presuming that the fixed income portion is already taken care of. So maybe for an investor, the most stock market exposure they want is 30%. And 70% is in money markets and CDs and treasury instruments or I-bonds or the like. But with the 30%, that is devoted to 100% equity portfolio. So I'm not switching between fixed income asset classes and equity asset classes. And again, I'm thinking beyond just myself. I'm thinking, again, years and years and years down the road. And even for someone who is older, the biggest problem for most older Americans is that they fear running out of money before they run out of life. And unless they have some type of indexed pension plan in addition to Social Security, that becomes a real problem. And stocks and equities are one of the few hedges against running out of this money before you run out of life.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just here for a moment on the subject of I-bonds, I have gone to the website www.savingsbonds.gov. So it looks like you can buy them direct that
okay.
way. And just a couple things people might want to keep in mind. It looks as if now the current rate is 6.7%. 1973 through April 2006. There is a max. You can only buy so much per year.
Exactly.
There's a cap, so that's $30,000 in a calendar year.
For individual.
And also people do need to keep in mind that you do need to hold them for, it looks like, five years.
5 years, yeah. David. That is the number.
So you should think
otherwise there are penalties.
That's right. And otherwise, so you should think about this as being a relatively long-term thing. So which makes me wonder if that, given the fact that you have to hold them for 5 years, is that really so much better than what you could do with a certificate of deposit?
Well, let's think about that. A five-year certificate of deposit also has penalties if you lock in 5 years. And the current rate, if you look at national CD rates for 5 years, you're looking in the 5% range, not the 6.78. Something else you want to keep in mind. When you purchase a certificate of deposit, the interest on a certificate of deposit, at least in the state of Illinois, is subject to Illinois income tax. When you are in a full-fledged treasury instrument, while, of course, the interest is subject to federal income tax, just like CD interest, it is not subject to state of Illinois income tax. Something else that you want to remember, and that is that the I-bonds adjust. So this is the current interest rate. So they're adjusting that four times a year. So there is an average that you are averaging into. But still, overall, that's a pretty handsome rate, because if we look at the five-year U.S. Treasury rate, and I'm just looking at yesterday's Wall Street Journal, so we would look at a February of 2011, the current Treasury note rate, the yield is about 4.6. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at 200 basis points or 2% beyond that. That's pretty tough to pass out if you want to go out and tie your money up for that period of time. And for many people, that might well make sense.
Yeah, and you do get the advantage, that, as you explained, that the tax on the interest is deferred until you redeem the bonds. So that, you know, theoretically, if you're using that as a long-term strategy, you put it out long enough, you get it to a point where maybe your tax situation is your tax situation should be lower, so that sort of
perhaps
is in the whole
mix. Perhaps.
You'd hope, you know. So.
Well, perhaps.
Okay, so
perhaps.
That's something to think about. Website
was?
www.savingsbonds, that's all as one word, savingsbonds.gov. And what I did when I looked for it was into my web browser, I just typed I-bonds, and this is what came up.
Perfect.
And then there's also other information there that has to do with different sorts of instruments there that you can get.
There's a plenty of them.
Okay. Let's see. Next, we'll talk with someone on a cell phone, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning. I have two questions for Professor Sinnoh. I have a trust, and I am not trustee of the trust. It's a corporate fiduciary. Upon my demise, the trust ends. I'd like to have my husband have something, and I was thinking that part of my annual disbursement of purchasing a large life insurance policy. I know you have poo-pooed them in the past, but I was wondering if that might be a good idea as far as the best payout.
Well, let me ask you a couple of preliminary questions. Is this a revocable or irrevocable trust?
Irrevocable.
All right. So you can't amend it. You can't change it. Everything is basically cast in stone.
Pretty much.
All right. And then you are the beneficiary of the trust. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So you basically are what's referred to as an income beneficiary, because all of the income from the trust is being distributed to you. Is that fair to say?
6% of the principal.
Okay, 6% of the principal is being distributed to you each year. And then at your death, the trust is going to terminate, and there's going to be a distribution to other beneficiaries?
Right, but not my spouse.
Okay, would that be children or grandchildren?
No.
All right, someone else.
Yes.
Okay, now I understand. And you would like to take a portion of this money and invest it perhaps in alternative investments, and one of the things that you are considering is a life insurance policy.
Yes. Now, that would be part of my income, meaning taking part of my income each year and purchased a life insurance policy for my spouse.
Okay, and how old are you?
I'm 60.
All right. And are you in good health?
I would say yes.
Well, the only reason I'm asking that is, number one, life insurance when you purchase it at age 60 is going to be rather expensive.
I know.
That's number one. And number two, it's really going to be expensive unless you are basically at the very top of the table rating, which means that you get the best rating on an insurance policy.
I probably would not be a preferred.
All right. Well, if you're not a preferred and you're age 60, I frankly would have a very, very difficult time imagining that this is going to be a decent investment in the event that you predecease your husband.
Can you make any other suggestions?
Well, let me ask you something else. Is your husband significantly younger than you are, or are you about the same age?
He's about 18 months younger.
All right. So he's not significantly younger. And based upon actuarial life expectancy, if we just go to normal actuarial tables, females, on average, outlive males by about 3 to 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So assuming that both of you are in reasonable health, the odds are that even though he is younger, you're going to outlive him.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Which then would defeat the whole purpose of your insurance policy.
But if I don't outlive him, one never knows.
No, one never knows.
Right.
But again, to buy an ordinary life policy, that would be a very expensive business, and based upon your age, the internal rate of return that you would earn on that policy probably would be less than 5 to 6%, assuming that you held that policy for a minimum of 20 years. So I really would hesitate to recommend that. If you were in your 40s, maybe even 45, yes, as part of a strategy, I could go along with that. I just have a lot of difficulty at age 60. So I probably would have my funds invested in some type of mutual funds, stocks, bonds, securities with an appropriate asset allocation. And then each year, dollar cost average, continue to buy more as you get distributions from the trust.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The second question I have is that for this trust, I am unhappy with the corporate fiduciary.
All right.
They are investing most of it into high-tech stocks, which I find very risky.
I find that risky also, especially for a trust, if that is indeed taking place. Let me ask you this. Is there a paragraph in the trust that says that the beneficiary or beneficiaries have the right to appoint another corporate trustee? Is that in the trust document? That is most unfortunate, and it is a huge mistake. And the reason I bring this up is that at least 80 or 90% of trusts are missing this essential language. And that is that if all of the beneficiaries or a majority of the beneficiaries vote to change the corporate trustee, they may do so, and they may move from one corporate trustee to another. So we could move from Northern Trust to LaSalle Bank Trust. And what that does is it makes the trustee much more responsive, if you will, to the needs and concerns and interests of the beneficiary, and at least listen to the beneficiary because they know they can lose the account and hence the money that they're charging to manage the trust. So the only reason I bring that up is for other people who have appointed corporate fiduciaries for their trust, they should have that provision in their trust document. Now, back to your question, if they are indeed basically investing in high-tech stocks, it would seem to me, absent some information to the contrary, that this would be a violation of what's called the prudent investment rule, or the prudent investor rule.
Mm-hmm.
And that can get a trustee in a lot of trouble. So if you feel that most of the corpus of the trust is being improperly invested, especially in high tech, then, and that's only one small asset class of the market, then I think that needs to be brought to the attention of the trustee directly through a letter and schedule a meeting with the trustee to discuss this matter.
Mm-hmm. How, if I want to get rid of them, what would I have to do?
I think you're probably bucking up a rock, a granite rock with no ceiling. I think it's going to be very, very tough unless you can prove fraud, some type of criminal activity. I think you can't get rid of that trustee, but you can bring to their attention that they may be in violation of the prudent investor rule, and if they don't change their ways, then you may, as a beneficiary, have a lawful action against the trustee. Now, I'm just throwing things out. I don't have any of the facts. So my suggestion is to consult what would be referred to as an ERISA, E-R-I-S-A, attorney. That's someone who specializes in laws concerning prudent investor rules, trusts, pension plans, etc. And there are many legal firms and law firms that specialize in these particular areas. So you would have to ask ahead of time, do you have someone who specializes in trust law and the application of the prudent investor rule?
I have to ask the trustee, or I just have to find out from another trust company that I might be interested in?
No, you're not going to be able to move to another trust company. That's not going to happen without provision in the trust. What I'm saying is, if you feel that this trust has been mismanaged and the positions in the trust have been mismanaged, then you might consult an attorney who specializes in this particular area of the law.
How do, assuming that this trust is in Pennsylvania, how do I go about that? How would I find?
If the trust was set up and situated in Pennsylvania, then the laws of Pennsylvania apply. Mm-hmm. So you would need to find a Pennsylvania attorney who specializes in trust and the prudent investor rule. You might be able to do an internet search. You might be able to go to your local lawyer who you currently do business and ask them to locate someone for you in the state of Pennsylvania. Then you could have a brief conversation, probably over the phone, with the people in Pennsylvania to see whether or not it makes any sense to go forward.
If I called you offline, would you be able to assist me with that?
I don't think so. I really don't practice law. I'm happy to just suggest this, but in terms of practicing law, I would be hesitant to do that. Happy to talk to you otherwise about it offline, but not in terms of assisting you procuring a lawyer. That's something that you need to do on your own.
Okay,
well, good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We have a couple of others. Let me just introduce again the guest. We're a little bit past the midpoint here, and our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business, and once a month, always on a Friday, he is here, and we talk about money management. So if you have questions, I know that he will do his best to try to help you out. This is one place you can go to get some advice. As I have said, taking nothing away from Dave, I always say to people, we want you to think very carefully about what you do with your money. Do your homework, do research, get lots of opinions. This is one place you can get one set of opinions. And I know that, as I say, he will do his best to help you out. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up is Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering, whatever happened to Janus Funds Investments, are they still in existence?
Yes, they certainly are. Janus Funds are still in existence. And while Janus Funds went through a difficult period of time when they made big bets in technology in the late 90s and early 2000s, most of those funds have been reallocated, and a number of them have done extraordinarily well as the market has recovered. So by all means, yes, the Janus funds are still in existence. One of the disappointing funds, I think, though, is the Janus Fund in particular, which was really sort of like a big cap fund, like an S&P 500 fund. And it just has been very disappointing and underperformed. And it's very interesting that the other major big time S&P 500 type actively managed fund is really Fidelity Magellan. And Fidelity Magellan, likewise, because of its size, has also really underperformed many of its peers. So, yes, Janus is still out there and is actively soliciting client accounts and has really made a very nice comeback in a number of their funds.
So are they still as big as they were, or have they downsized?
Well, they're actually smaller in terms of overall market value, as a number of funds are, because if you'll remember, back in 1999 and early 2000 with the high-tech boom, a lot of these mutual funds had huge holdings in these technology positions, so the actual market value of these funds shot up dramatically high. And when those particular positions dropped in value, likewise, the value or the overall market value of the mutual funds dropped. So many, many funds have really not recovered, if you will, in terms of the overall market value or market share they had as compared to 2000.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to another caller here. This is someone on cell phone, line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I have a, I'm almost a financial illiterate, but I have a good ambition, and I have a student loan I'm begun to pay on, and I want to know how I'd be able to go about refinancing it. And I also left the school district, built up a retirement fund, and I want to know how I could reinvest that. And also the web address for the station so that I can check the couch potato portfolio also.
Okay. Well, that I can give you right off, and it's really easy. It's WILL.UIUC.EDU. And if you go there to click on AM and then you go to this program, Focus 580, it's there.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a preliminary question. How old are you?
44.
Okay. And are you saying that you still have some student loans that you are paying on?
I have not begun to pay on them yet, but they are quite due, and I want to begin to pay on them, but I don't know if going through the standard government loan system is beneficial to me financially.
So currently you have some outstanding student loans that were generated through the student National Student Loan Program?
Yes.
All right. I've got to confess to you that I'm not an expert on that.
Okay.
There were some opportunities, I know a year and a half ago, that I advised a number of students that they could refinance at lower rates those particular student loans, but I can't tell you specifically what those rules are and the refinancing opportunities with those student loans at the current time. Do you have an idea of what interest rate that you'll be charged?
8. I believe it's 8.
8%?
Yes.
My guess is, and this is just purely a surmise and a guess, that you should be able to refinance that student loan at a lower interest rate.
Right.
All right. Are you a homeowner?
No, I'm not.
Okay. So you need to look into that, and probably the college or the university where you originally went to school, obtained that loan, probably could give you that information. I'm sorry, I'm just not an expert on that area.
That's fine.
All right. Now, the next question is that you're telling me that at your previous position that you had accumulated monies in a retirement fund.
Yes.
All right. And is that a – what type of plan was that? Was that a pension plan or was that a – profit sharing or 403B plan? Do you know what kind of plan it was?
I believe it was 403B.
All right. So it's a 403B plan. Now, typically with the 403B plan, you've got a number of choices. The first choice is you can leave the 403B plan with your employer sponsor so long as you have more than $5,000 in the plan.
Okay.
All right. So you could continue to utilize the choices, the menu of choices that are available at your current 403B plan sponsor. Just because you're no longer employed doesn't mean you have to take the money out.
Okay.
All right. Now, do you have good choices where you had that 403B plan?
I'm not quite sure. I hadn't begun to investigate. I just assumed that my options elsewhere would be better.
Well, do you know what options you have currently? Do you have some large mutual fund choices, for example?
I believe I have to contribute as an employee. Elsewise, I have to take the fund. I have to end the fund to be able to get the money.
Well, yeah, you can't. Once you're no longer there, you can't contribute any longer. But again, where's your money currently invested? How do you have it invested currently?
I believe it's in a stock portfolio, but I've never really investigated what investments they make with the money.
Okay, well, it sounds to me like you need to do some homework.
Okay.
And number one, you need to check on what choices you have with your 403B plan, because typically you can leave the money in, but you need to understand the various menu of choices. Clearly, at age 44, you need to be saving for retirement, so the lion's share of these funds should be well diversified in a stock portfolio or stock mutual funds. That's number one. Number two, since you are no longer employed through your employer sponsor, you do have the right to take that money out and roll it over into your own self-directed IRA program.
Okay.
That is a tax-free rollover. Your plan sponsor currently would have the paperwork for that, and you could move to a brokerage firm. You could go to a mutual fund company. You could go to a bank. There are a variety of places, but I caution you, before you just do that, do some more research and figure out where it makes the most sense. It might make sense for you, based upon what you're telling me, is to spend perhaps a few dollars with a fee financial planner. A
right.
fee financial planner who can then give you a variety of alternatives and better understand your financial circumstances. So I think, one, you need to do some homework yourself. Two, you need to locate a fee financial planner, spend an hour or two with them so that you make good choices with this money, either leaving it where it is or rolling it over into your own self-directed IRA. That's a tax-free rollover, saving it for retirement, and making good choices. So I think that's the next steps in the program.
Fantastic.
Okay.
I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, thanks very much. And one thing, too, you didn't mention it, but I'm sure it's important for him to realize, you've mentioned this before, that if you do that rollover, it must be a trustee-to-trustee transfer. That money should never touch the money, because if you do,
20%.
It's immediately the government would say, okay, let's have our cut. It's got to go from the one place to the other.
Essentially, you don't have the check made out to you. That's really the bottom line. It's made out to the next trustee for your benefit.
All
absolutely.
Right. Let's go to Southern Illinois for another caller here. Line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm 54 years old, and next year I will be eligible to retire from the place I work with a pension of about $1,400. My wife is retiring this year. As a full-time school teacher, she'll have about $2,300 coming in every month.
How old is she?
She's 56.
Okay.
And I'm just twiddling my thumbs. I'll have insurance. I'll have a small pension. I've got about $200,000 in a 401k. I'm just twiddling my thumbs whether to wait till I'm 59 and a half. My pension would be precipitously almost $1,000 a month more. But I'm looking at the timeline. You know, how long am I going to live? You know, I have a lot of questions and a lot I need to go through. My main thing is, where can I go and take all my numbers and get really professional advice? Somebody that handles nothing but retirements and where I'm at, so I can make an intelligent decision based on all the facts.
Yeah, I think you're in an interesting position, and you do want to have it properly analyzed. I think what you're looking for is a certified financial planner, a CFP, who specializes in retirement planning. I'd look for someone who has a minimum of 10 years of experience. That CFP might also turn out to be a CPA as well. You can go to the Certified Financial Planning Board of Standards, and they have a complete listing of all CFPs in the country, and you can look at those in your area. Maybe you have a source of referral from someone, but I think you're looking for a CFP typically what I would refer to as a fee-only financial planner. They usually are very cognizant and up-to-date on investment planning, income tax planning, insurance planning, and retirement planning as well, so they can do a needs-based analysis for you. They have the mathematical formulas. Typically, they have software that will do that right for you with all kinds of different assumptions. That's what you're looking for. You're looking for a fee-only, certified financial planner who knows a lot about retirement planning and can run those numbers for you.
You wouldn't have, by any chance, have a website punch in CFP?
If you just Google in or punch in CFP, you will come up with the Certified Financial Planning Board of Standards, all right? That's the national organization that certifies financial planners, and I believe that on that website you can go and get a list of financial planners in your area who are certified. You can always go to contact us at the Certified Financial Board of Standards website. They have an 800 number. It's a consumer line. You can call in on that. They can take you through the website, or they can refer you directly to people in your area.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the call. Let's go again to another caller. This is Urbana. It's line two. Hello.
Good morning. We have a daughter in college. Under that $12,000 gift provision you mentioned,
yes,
are we able to basically create a fund for her from which she can pay, say, her rent, her board, and at the same time subtract it from our taxes? Is that what I'm understanding?
Well, there is a college savings account program that is IRS approved. They're called Educational College Savings Plans, and they're sponsored by every state, but you may be just a little bit late to set one up. Are you calling from Illinois?
Yes.
Okay.
Arizona.
All right. Well, if you live in Arizona?
Illinois.
Oh, you live in Illinois. All right. Well, there are two programs in Illinois, and the one that probably you're thinking about is a program where you could invest money, and then that money could be utilized to pay any college expenses, room, board, tuition, fees, etc. The Illinois program is called the Bright Star program. But again, usually these are set up when children are very young, so the money is allowed to grow and invest at tax-free returns. So if you had a daughter that was 3, 4, or 5 years old and you put in $10,000, $12,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000, all of the earnings grow tax-free on those assets. So when your daughter would pull them out for college, then there would be presumably substantial amounts of money in the plan, and you wouldn't pay any tax, nor would she, so long as it's used for some type of college expenses. Where you already have your daughter in college, it's a bit tougher because you can gift her. You don't get a tax break for this. You can gift her money up to $12,000, so you and your spouse could gift $24,000 a year to pay for these expenses. And in addition to that, something little understood, if you write the tuition and fee check directly to the University of Illinois out of your checking account, and you write that, that really doesn't go against the $12,000 number for the year. So it's a little bit late to set up a plan unless your daughter is contemplating professional school where she would not be on scholarship. She was planning to go to graduate school. Most graduate students, frankly, are going to get some kind of graduate support while they're in school. So that really doesn't work. But lots of times if she was going to go to medical school, maybe law school, it may not be too late to look into a college savings program.
Okay, so basically the gift program from us as parents to her comes at no tax advantage to us.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Just to follow up real quick again on this issue of this question of finding a certified financial planner, I did hear in my computer what you said. I typed in CFP and came to the website of the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards.
That's
and
it.
There is a place here where you can search. You put in your zip code, and here it comes up with 38 names of people here. Within 10 miles of Champaign-Urbana, and pretty much they're all in either Champaign, Urbana, St. Joe. There's some people in Savoy, and It lists whether they're certified. It lists whether there's any disciplinary history. And so that would be one way to go. So I don't know, though, how you choose among these 38 people which one you're going
to
get.
Well, I think the first question when you talk to them is you would ask them, number one, are they fee only? All right?
Okay.
That's the question number one. Mm. Can I come in, visit with you, and you only charge me a fee? You're not going to try to sell me something. That's number one. And number two, I want someone with a substantial level of experience. How many years of experience do you have? And number three, then you could chat briefly over the phone and just see if there's some chemistry with this person. So I would certainly talk to several. And lo and behold, you'll find one or two. These are typically very ethical people. They comply with strict standards. Otherwise, they would lose their CFP designation. And typically, you want to ask them, do you have particular expertise in retirement planning or the needs and benefits that I'm going to be facing in my retirement years?
Okay.
All right.
Well, I guess at about that point, we will finish for this time around with our thanks to our guest, David Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance at U of I. He's here once a month, almost on Friday, to answer questions on money management. One place you can go to ask questions. And we're very pleased to have you here.
Dave, thanks so very much. I thought the questions today were really very multivariate, lots of fun. And thanks for having me on WILL.